You're listening to an edited version of the live Voices of Montana statewide radio program. Find us on Facebook and subscribe for further podcasts wherever you get your audio on demand. I'm Tom Schultz, host of the program. Thanks for joining us, and please feel free to contact me at studio@voicesofmontana.com. It's time to catch up to date with our Attorney General. Austin Knutson joins us now. A lot going on. Attorney General Knutson, how are you?
I'm doing good, Tom. How are you?
Oh, I'm hanging in there. Gee, you do anything fun this weekend, or is it... I know you like to get back to the ranch near Culbertson as often as you can. Did you manage that this weekend?
You know, I did not. I haven't been back. I've been back once since I got elected. That's how busy we've been.
Yeah, I know. You've been real super busy, and I appreciate the work coming out of the office. There's a lot of things I kind of want to talk about here and catch up to date on. Of course, the Keystone XL lawsuit. I'm not sure, you know, if there is anything to update on there. You made a binding opinion on critical race theory, and that one is I think top of my mind here too. Talk about why the Attorney General's office needs to weigh in on this educational issue.
Well, we weighed in because we were requested to weigh in by the Superintendent of Public Instruction. Mm-hmm. Superintendent Arnson, pursuant to her legal power, asked us to render an opinion on the legality of critical race theory. So what my office did, we did a deep dive on all aspects of critical race theory. This is a fairly new educational theory out there. It's being promulgated by the U.S. Department of Education. It's starting to trickle down and make it through, you know, frankly, a lot of our states, and this is something that we see coming. I hear a lot of people saying, oh, this isn't a thing in Montana. I think that's probably technically true. There are no schools teaching it yet, but we do know there's some exploratory committees put together in some of these school districts, and some of this curriculum was starting to be promulgated, and I suspect that that's what encourage Superintendent Arnson to request the opinion.
As you did a deep dive into critical race theory, and I've done, I guess, my fair share of deep diving into it too, it's hard to kind of put a handle on here is what critical race theory is, or I think it's even harder to talk about how it's being manifested into our education system. Can you kind of go into that a little bit?
Well, you've actually hit the nail on the head perfectly, and one of the real problems that we discovered about critical race theory. But basically, critical race theory teaches that racism is institutional in America. Mm-hmm. It's not something historical. It's not something that, you know, we're trying to correct. It just exists everywhere. It's always existed, and there's really nothing we can do about it but engage in further racism in the opposite. And that's just anathema to our constitutions, both our federal and state. And frankly, that's illegal. This is a country that's founded on equality, on equal opportunity. And we do not tolerate racism of any kind. And that's really what was happening with what you find with a lot of these critical race theory curriculums and teachings, is that they were literally segregating children by their race. They're segregating teachers by their race. They're teaching different school lessons to children according to their race. That is blatantly illegal, both under federal law and state law, and it's flagrantly unconstitutional. So that's the kind of stuff that we really stepped in and said, no, you can't do that.
And that's exactly what is happening. I mean, I'll have specific, and I've given them out on the radio, specific lessons that teachers are using. Of course, the 1619 Project is another one of those things that we have talked about here. So they are using race as a basis, as you mentioned, for just teaching critical race theory. It's involved in every social, cultural, and legal aspect, racism is, of our society. So let me go with that to, I don't know if you've read this opinion by members of some of Montana as well. Shane Morjo wrote an opinion, Representative Tyson Running Wolf. I'm not sure if you've seen that. Maybe it's not fair for me to ask about it, but they said in 1972, the Montana legislature overwhelmingly approved and endorsed the teaching of critical race theory. That's quote unquote from a response to State Superintendent of Public Instruction Elsie Arnson's op-ed regarding critical race theory. Did you catch that one, Austin?
I did. I've caught that one. There's been a couple others. And frankly, Tom, I wish these people were as good at reading as they are about talking and screaming. This is a bit frustrating because when I read these opinions out there, it's clear to me these people have never read the opinion that we issued. Period. We make it very clear in our binding opinion that there is nothing in this that prevents the teaching of history. And absolutely, racism is a part of American history. It's an ugly part. It's a part that none of us are proud of. But look, those who ignore history are doomed to repeat it. We absolutely need to teach our children about history. We need to teach them about racism and the Civil War. We need to teach them about the Trail of Tears and all kinds of stuff that happened to Native Americans.
Yeah.
Tom, I'm a tribal member. This is important to me as well. So the idea here that we are somehow telling school districts and teachers that they can't teach certain aspects of history because it's triggering, that is absolutely not true. We make that explicitly clear in this very detailed opinion. And again, this just shows me these people are more interested in screaming than they are in reading.
Well, and that's part of the problem here when we're talking about instituting critical race theory. There seems to be so much politics behind it. It was originated in the mid-70s. It goes along with critical legal studies. I mean, there's some value, I think, in understanding what they're trying to purport here, but I think it's being manipulated in a lot of ways. So the opinion that you issued, go into that. How is it binding? What happens if a parent believes that their child is being educated in the public school system in regards to critical race theory? Again, it's hard to put a finger on what that is because it's ill-defined.
Well, and that's exactly right. So before I talk remedies, let me just hit on that really real quick. That's actually one of the biggest problems that I see with critical race theory is that it is completely subjective. There are no objective standards or goalposts, really, when you're talking about critical race theory. None of the scholars who promulgate this wildly controversial theory can really point to anything concrete and say, okay, this is racism and this is critical race theory. It is completely subjective. It depends on the whims of the day. It depends on who you're talking to. And it's completely subjective emotionality. That's not what we teach our children. That's not how we should be teaching our children. We should be teaching our children rationality and objectivity. And there's nothing in critical race theory that is either. So with that said, a parent in Montana believes that their child is being segregated or illegally discriminated against, because that's ultimately what we're talking about when we're talking about critical race theory. Your child or a teacher has to be illegally discriminated against based upon their race solely. What can you do? Well, you can contact the Montana Department of Justice. That's number one. That's my agency. You can report that to us. You can report it to the Superintendent of Public Instruction at the Office of Public Instruction. They can also file suit. They can file a lawsuit in district court in Montana under the Montana Human Rights Act, because that's a flagrant violation of the Montana Human Rights Act and also our state equal protection clause. Frankly, they could file a federal lawsuit under the U.S. Civil Rights Act or under the federal equal protection clause. So we've identified multiple ways here in which critical race theory or certain aspects of it are flagrantly unconstitutional, flagrantly illegal, and we've laid down some bright line rules here of what can and cannot be taught under this theory in Montana.
Let me ask this, and just as a point here, I mentioned this a couple of times on the air in previous shows, that, you know, it's as early as first grade in some places across the country in school districts where this is being taught, you're being asked to evaluate your life based on your race as a first grader. So it is happening in a lot of ways. Do you think this kind of gets ahead of it in Montana, or what's the fallout? Are other states understanding this and looking to this opinion to make a difference in their jurisdictions?
I don't think there's going to be a lot of fallout in Montana. Frankly, I don't think there were many school districts in Montana who were looking at implementing this. You know, I come from a Class C school in northeastern Montana. And it was a very integrated school. We were next to an Indian reservation, next to Fort Peck. We had tribal kids. You know, we had a lot of integration in that school. I think that speaks to a lot of Montana schools. I don't think this was a huge issue in Montana, but it's not fair to say that it wasn't an issue at all, and then that this was made up out of whole cloth. We do know that there were certain school districts in Montana that were taking a hard look at this. I'm going to single out Bozeman. The Bozeman School District, we know for sure, had put together a committee and was looking at integrating critical race theory into their curriculum. So I think the thought here from Superintendent Aronson and from myself is to get ahead of this. Look, that's some bright lines. According to the U.S. Constitution, according to the state constitution, and according to state and federal law, which are very, very crystal clear on this subject. You do not fix past discrimination by engaging in current discrimination. That is not the fix to racism in this country, and we reject wholly these, frankly, evil, discriminatory practices.
Yeah, it seems to make just common sense, and especially some of the language that you issued in your ruling here. I sort of sarcastically mentioned that on Friday, but this extends to every, you know, segregating students in any capacity based on race is illegal. And it seems like that is even language that, I don't know, that's common sense sort of stuff. So I appreciate you know, taking the time and looking into this, and I think it's important for us. Let's talk about two more states joining your lawsuit against Biden administration's cancellation of the Keystone XL pipeline. Is there an update on that? Is that moving along? Is the Biden administration? I know they sort of just keep kicking things down the road for a lot of reasons, mostly political. But where's that at?
Yeah, so we're very happy about this lawsuit. We're in front of a judge in the Southern District of Texas. We had a hearing scheduled for about a month ago, but it got pushed back for kind of procedural reasons. This was largely an administrative hearing to set some schedules, set some discovery deadlines. That hearing still hasn't happened yet, but I think we're set here within another week or two. Very excited that we had two more states join our coalition. We had the state of Alaska and the state of Florida both jump onto our lawsuit. So we're now up to 23 states pushing back on the Biden administration's unilateral and frankly, arbitrary cancellation of the Keystone XL pipeline. Tom, this one's particularly important to me as an Eastern Montana guy. This was a pipeline that was set to travel across six of the poorest counties in Montana, bring in tremendous tax relief to property taxpayers in those counties, but also bring in a lot of new tax dollars to the state and to those counties. Joe Biden on day one snaps his fingers and says, no, we don't like that. I find it very, very hypocritical that here just a few weeks ago we had a major gas pipeline get shut down on the East Coast. We saw gasoline prices spike as a result of that shutdown from a hack attack. And suddenly the Biden administration is in favor of pipelines. They're suddenly admitting that pipelines are the cheapest, safest way to transport petroleum. Now, Tom, I'm a Bakken guy. I'm from Bainville. Anybody up there will tell you pipelines are absolutely safer than rail cars. They're safer than oil trucks on the highway. Those trucks, they do get in accidents. Those trains, they do derail, and they spill oil. Once in a while, a pipeline will spring a leak. Yep, that happens, but you're talking barrel for barrel, and just looking at the numbers, mathematically, those pipelines are by far the safest, most reliable way to transport oil and fuel in the country. And this is a huge project that was going to bring a lot of new crude oil to American refineries that was going to get out to American gas stations and drop the price of fuel. That's what we're talking about here, keeping the price of gas down for Americans and for Montanans. And, you know, you don't have to look very far. Joe Biden's been in office in 6 months, and what's the price of gas done?
Yeah, yeah, and it's politics in a lot of ways. You know, there's obviously some supply and demand issues going on, but politically, when you cut down the supply and the demand, you know, is what it is, this is what's happening. the have you had any conversations with Canada? Because I know that they have weighed in about the possibility of initiating their own lawsuit over this action.
I've had several conversations with both the premiers of Alberta and Saskatchewan and their legal team. They've been very productive conversations. Last conversation we had with the premier in Saskatchewan, I think they're actually going to try to intervene and join our lawsuit, which is tremendous. You know, we've got an international coalition here now getting involved. And really, that's the crux of the argument here. When you look at the U.S. Constitution, the president does not have the authority to deal in international commerce. That is a power that is specifically reserved to the Congress. Congress acted on that 10 years ago, and Joe Biden is trying to go back in time and issue a veto that, frankly, he doesn't have the power to do. So those conversations have gone very well. Our northern partners are very concerned about this project. Obviously, it was a big boon to them. But look, they've already laid a lot of money on the table when you're talking about what they've already put in the ground up in Canada and the investment they've already made. And they're basically being told now by a foreign president that they're going to lose all that investment. That would make me pretty upset, too.
Yeah, and thank you for that. I mean, I think there's recourse. This is not a closed case, that's for sure. Wanted to just quickly get an update before we run out of time on the Montana Missing Indigenous Persons Task Force. What's new there?
Yeah, you bet. Thanks, Tom. We had two bills come out of the legislature, one that extended the Murdered and Missing Indigenous Persons Task Force, and one that gave us a few more people on that. So we're set to have our first meeting of that task force here very soon, within the next couple of weeks. And we're looking for additional people who would like to serve on that task force. If you're interested, check out mtdoj.gov. But, I mean, this is a very important issue. Obviously, me being from up in the Fort Peck area, it's an issue I'm familiar with. I was a county attorney up there, a county prosecutor on the Fort Peck Reservation. It's an issue that's near and dear to me. It's a very difficult issue to deal with in the state of Montana. But that's the point of this task force, is we're trying to bridge some jurisdictional gaps and, you know, try to collaborate with tribal governments and with the federal government, frankly, where we can, because that's where we have a lot of the jurisdictional problems when you're trying to deal with this issue. So very important one, one we're taking very seriously here at the Department of Justice. And we're keeping these task forces moving forward.
I think a lot of people are encouraged by this too, Austin.
Yeah, I mean, it's a difficult issue. It's one that no one likes to talk about. We know that human trafficking is drastically increasing here in Montana. When we use that term, it's kind of a catch-all term. We can be talking about sex trafficking, prostitution, child sex exploitation. These are difficult subjects. These are things that no one likes to talk about. They're uncomfortable. But we have to recognize that we've got a growing problem here in Montana with it. Our prosecution of these crimes is up very, very sharply and dramatically. And we need to recognize that this is a growing problem in Montana. And it specifically is a problem for our tribal citizens.
Yeah.
Tribal females are, you know, they make up about 4% of our state population, but 40% of our missing population. That's staggering. So this is a huge issue, and we're trying to dig into it and put a stop to it here.
Yeah, it's very appreciated across the state. I know Attorney General Knutson here. You made a statement, and it was the confirmation hearing, not the confirmation exactly, of David Chapman to be director of the ATF, along with you and other states. Why are you guys weighing in on this?
Well, because this is a bad dude. This is a guy who is just a flagrant, open, hostile enemy of the Second Amendment. He makes no bones about that. About the only good thing I can say about him is he's at least honest about who he is to the public. This is a guy who was a former ATF agent. He was involved with the Waco investigation. But as a result of that, you know, I don't know if that was a sea change for him or what, but he has become one of the preeminent anti-Second Amendment advocates in the country. This is a guy that's worked for Gabby Gifford's campaign. This is a guy that's worked for numerous anti-Second Amendment nonprofit organizations. This is a guy that's called for the confiscation and registration of, you know, basically any semi-automatic rifle that holds more than 10 rounds. Tom, I'm a big gun guy. I'm very clear about that. I'm very open about that. I'm a competitive shooter. I'm a three gunner. I'm a reloader. I'm a gun collector. Guns and shooting are my hobby.
Yep.
This is something I know a lot about.
And without a doubt, I know a big supporter of the Second Amendment. I apologize. We're going to run out of time. Thank you for the work you're doing there. And we'll catch up with you again. Okay, Austin, be well, sir.
Thanks, Tom.
You're listening to a podcast from the live Voices of Montana radio show. Be sure to check out the full podcast page at voicesofmontana.com for a full listing of all our programs. We've been covering Montana issues for more than 20 years. Thanks for listening today.
It was 3 days last week, and we looked at it a little bit. Logan Health Nurses went on strike at the Kalispell Hospital. This was over a contract dispute, which was mostly pay and staffing, the main disputes there. But the backstory is an interesting one, and it involves unionization. A couple of years ago, I think there's roughly about 650 nurses up there. They voted, a majority of them anyway, voted to unionize with SEIU. That's the Service Employees International Union. So that's part of the backstory here, because the issues that they're looking at here, pay and staffing, there's always that's always, I think, fair to address those things, those concerns with management. But you wonder if union tactics are making the situation better or worse. There are, in fact, a large number of nurses in that community that are saying it is making it worse. And there's an ad hoc group, an informal organization called Nurses and Community Unite. And what they've been trying to do is, and I think they've been successful to some degree in getting the National Labor Relations Board to get in there and possibly have a vote to de-unionize. And we're going to catch up to date on that. Julie Johnson is with us. 3 decades of experience as a nurse, 28 there in Kalispell, and then Todd Bernhardt as well. He has a working relationship with the hospital, but that's not associated specifically with the nurses. But he's here as a community member, community spokesperson for Nurses and Community Unite. Thank you so much, both, for being here. Julie, let's start with you there. 28 years at Kalispell, 3 decades of experience as a nurse. I say it a lot. I have nursing friends. I know people in the healthcare profession. You guys do a ton of work. You are so appreciated in what you do.
Ah, thanks, Tom. I really appreciate it. Yeah, it's a great profession, but we're in a little bit of a mess up here. I really enjoy what I do. I grew up in Montana. I grew up in a little town over on the east side of the mountains. My husband's from Great Falls. I started off my nursing career in downtown Portland. I worked for a big hospital there, but after a couple of years, you know, Montana called us home, and so my husband and I moved to Kalispell in December of 93, and I started working for Logan Health in February of 94, and I've been there ever since. We have 2 kids. Both my kids were born at the hospital here, and, you know, really feel lucky and blessed to be able to live and work and make a living here in this beautiful Flathead Valley.
And so with and thank you for that. And with all that background up there in the area, in the Flathead Valley, you've got some history with this organization. Give us your thoughts on this dispute, this 3-day strike, and what's going on there with the unionization.
You know, we've seen a lot of change in the hospital here. And especially over the past 5 to 7 years. And I think from a nursing standpoint, nursing sort of feels like, you know, past management had made a lot of questionable decisions, and the nurses sort of felt like they were left behind or overlooked in the many of those decisions. And I think the final straw for the nurse was nursing, you know, for the nurses from their standpoint, was a few years ago, past management had done this huge restructuring process. And part of that process was that they had removed or decided to let go or to remove many of the charge nurse positions up on the floor. And also at that time removed a lot of the CNA positions on that floor. And nursing was not consulted in that decision. And so that created a lot of anger, a lot of angst, a lot of negativity, and a lot of mistrust of management. And so you know, when they weren't consulted in a lot of those decisions, they really felt like they had no voice. And so the only way that they felt like they were going to get that voice back was to go union. And so here we are 19 months later, and we're really no better off. I mean, we've been negotiating for 19 months, and, you know, obviously the negotiations aren't going well because we just finished a strike. And so that's how this nurses and community group got started. You know, SEIU has voted in a closed shop, which means whether you're for it or against it, you are all nurses need to be a part of it. And, you know, you complicate that with Montana not being a right to work state. And so all nurses are included, whether you're for it or against it. And we're forced to pay dues. And, you know, dues to an organization that, you know, many of us feel don't reflect our core values, individual core values, our community core values, and really our state of Montana core values. And those dues are, you know, for a nurse that makes about $35 an hour, that comes to about $1,000 per year per nurse. You know, and there's almost 700 nurses. So you're talking, you know, $1,000 times 700 nurses. That's $700,000 that's leaving the valley. And, you know, and if the SEIU has said that if they get a nursing contract with the nurses, their plan is to move into other areas or other departments. And so that number could increase. Again, that money goes to a Seattle-based institution that, you know, has ties to Washington, D.C., that, again, that supports policies and legislation that we really feel don't reflect our common core values, nor our community or state's common core values.
Appreciate that, Julie. Go ahead.
Yeah, it's really caused, you know, a lot of angst. And so we have nurses against management, and, you know, the union came in, and now we have nurses against nurses, and, you know, they've got the community tied in now, and so we have community against, you know, the hospital, and we've got community against the nurses, and nurses against the community. So it's really caused a lot of angst, and, you know, it's just a really tough place to be right now.
Yeah, and I appreciate you saying that, because I think that's the thing that if we peel back, you know, the curtains here a little bit, That is something that makes it real difficult and affects everybody's health care. Is that sort of thing going on there? And so resolution toward that, Todd Bernhardt, is working with the National Labor Relations Board, signing a petition to get a vote to de-unionize. Talk about that process, Todd.
Sure. So, yeah, thank you again for having us on. That process involves we need to get to at least 30% of the nurses in the bargaining unit to sign a petition to say, hey, we want to have a revote. And so we filed last week with 40% signatures, and the National Labor Relations Board is going through validating the, you know, those signatures. I'm sure the SEIU would, you know, prefer to knock some of those signatures off. So this in the evaluation process. And so what happens next is if we have that 30% of current bargaining unit nurses, then we'll move to a revote. And that revote will happen somewhere in the next 30 to 60 days. On average, I think right now it's taken about 33 days. And at that point, you just need 50% of the voting nurses to overturn and decertify the union. That's a bit of what the process looks like.
I wanted you to talk a little bit, too, as Julie had noted, past management questionable decisions. And I think that's fair. What's legit? And maybe Julie can respond to that in here in just a little bit. But you had mentioned as we were chatting about this that the administration was in a period of transition and when this vote took place, and you feel – what's your thoughts now on that transition?
Sure. And, you know, just, I guess, a little bit of background, even though my primary involvement with the Nurses and Community Unite group is as a community member, I've worked at the hospital supporting the IT infrastructure for the last 12 years. So I do have a bit of a perspective there. And as Julie said, you know, there was a period where we went through, you know, a longtime CEO passed away. We went into an interim CEO situation, permanent CEO situation, interim CEO situation, and then finally their current CEO situation. So a number of years where there was a lot of change, and as Julie said, there's some nursing pain points along the way. And you know, as a group, we're not suggesting that the nursing pain points aren't real and don't need to be addressed.
Yeah.
What we're advocating for now is removing that middleman, the SEIU, from that equation. When the union was voted in, you know, Dr. Craig Lambrecht, our current CEO, had only been on the ground for 2 to 3 months. And so really he kind of inherited the situation, and now he's been on the ground for almost 2 years, and he has a team in place. He understands the culture of the organization. He understands the people, and he has been working to improve the situation at the hospital, you know, pay in particularly in different departments, and including my own. And so I think we've seen where he's demonstrated that he is willing to come to the table and help move the organization forward. And I think, you know, right now he has handcuffs on because of the contract situation and the SEIU situation. So if the union is voted out, decertified, that removes those handcuffs, and he can move forward then with helping improve the situation directly with the nurses. And so, you know, that's really, I think, where we're headed and where we're what we're advocating for.
Julie, I wanted to ask your thoughts on what the I know it's a closed shop, used to say, and you're all unionized nurses, but increased staffing, reinstating a charged nurse, as you mentioned, a nurse staffing committee, other improvements. So, talk about addressing those issues.
Well, you know, there's a lot of issues that they're trying to be addressed, and, you know, pay, like you say, is a large portion of it. Health insurance is a large portion of it. And I think what we need to remember too is you don't start with what you have. You start, when you negotiate, you don't start with what you have. You start at the, you know, from the very bare basics. And so, that's a hard place to start, you know. It's a give and take on both sides. And, really, you know, our staffing, we're actually above the national average with our staffing. Our turnover rate is actually below the national average. So I think we're doing really well there. We definitely have management's attention, and I think that's what we really need to focus on, is we have their attention. You know, Dr. Lambrecht was only here for a couple of months when the vote went in, and I agree with Todd. He knows the lay of the land now. He's got people in place. He held open forums prior to the vote where he sat down with us in little town hall meetings, and so he definitely knows our concerns. And I feel like we can solve our issues by taking the divisiveness of the SEIU out and forming nursing leadership councils, where we have some really strong nursing leaders amongst our group, and we've gotten nowhere in our negotiations. I mean, we've been doing this for 19 months. We just came out of a strike. What I think we need to do is to really step back and say, is this really the direction that we want to go? You know, are we any better off than we were 19 months ago? And, you know, I really feel like no, the answer is no. And so forming these nursing leadership councils, and sitting down, reaching across the table, face-to-face with our management team, and working together as one team with one mission, Nurses United, working with our management team face-to-face to solve our problems.
Thank you, Julie. Appreciate that. We're out of time, but we'll be following the issue. Todd, keep me up to date, okay?
All right. Yeah, thank you very much, Tom.
Yeah, thank you both for your time here. Appreciate that.